Thank you, everybody, good evening. Why did Alan Turing kill himself? Well, from our current perspective, there is an obvious superficial answer to give, having to do with his arrest and all the homophobia surrounding it. The embarrassment of his arrest, the unpleasantness of the treatment that he was subject to, the stress from the legal proceedings. But let's trace this back to the cause of this arrest. How did all of this get started? Well, he was burgled. There was a theft of some of his personal property, and this came indirectly through an acquaintance of his. Well, why was Turing associating with such people? These people were kind of down and out. He had picked somebody up, was developing a relationship with somebody he'd met on the street, and it was a friend of this guy who actually committed the burglary. These people were on the more difficult side of life, I guess you could say, unemployed, no money. Turing was a college professor, a great researcher, and a war hero, even though that wasn't known at the time. What was he doing associating with such people? Well, this would even be possible today. I don't want to make too much of a big deal about the difference in the social circumstances between then and now. But Turing was facing some situations that are very different from today. He didn't have an awful lot of alternatives for good ways to meet good people for him. Well, things weren't that bad for Turing. He was associated with King's College, right across the street from here, effectively. King's College provided a very protective atmosphere for gays at the time. King's College was associated with various groups, like the Bloomsbury Group and the Apostles, which had many prominent gay members. For instance, E.M. Foster, the novelist, Ludwig Wittgenstein, the philosopher, John Maynard Keynes, the economist, and Lytton Strachey, also a writer. But this apparently didn't provide a lot of benefit for Turing himself. Turing apparently didn't really fit in to that crowd. And I would guess that was in large part because Turing was too much of a stereotypical mathematician. A bit shy, somewhat nerdy, awkward in public, likely did not really have the savoir-faire of these more literary and worldly people. Even Hardy, G.H. Hardy, who was associated with King's and gay and a mathematician, even with Hardy, Turing didn't develop any kind of real relationship. They knew each other, they were acquainted. What the reason for that was, they didn't get on any better than that, I don't really know. Maybe just personality differences, maybe there was a generational difference that got in the way, you know, I really don't know. But Turing was definitely confronting a lack of other alternatives. If he couldn't make contact with like-minded people at his college, at his university, what about other alternatives? Well, back then, there was no gay and lesbian community center. There were no gay sports groups he could go to. He was a runner. There was no front runners, his international gay lesbian running group that he could join. There were no gay wrestling clubs that he could go to. There were no gay music groups, no gay political groups. Even to get a broad circle of friends must have been more difficult. The gay community was much smaller back then. A lot of people were closeted, didn't know they were gay, living sham lives and sham marriages, no websites, no internet where you can contact people, basically no gay community. Now, I guess I should point out, to give a balanced account here, having a community is somewhat of a mixed blessing. There tends to be a certain oppression within small groups. Whenever you have a minority group, within a society which is itself oppressed by the larger society, well, the group tends to build their own form of oppression, but there's a certain standard of behavior that they expect people to adhere to. So, for instance, I would say myself that I have met more than my fair share of hairdressers and interior designers over the years. And in fact, I don't even know myself how well I fit into this group, because I'm very much function as a mathematician. My sense of art and design is not among the greatest. There's often reference to a gay gene going around for people with a certain flair for certain things. Well, I kind of feel like a mutant sometimes. I've been known to say that I'm actually a straight man trapped in a gay man's body. For the Americans in the audience who might understand this reference, sometimes I think I'm just a shame to my race, as opposed to being a credit to your race, if you remember that one. So let me put this in a somewhat broader context. Not only was there no gay community really for Turing to turn to, there was a lot of social homophobia that Turing had to deal with. Not just no gay community, but a lack of wider community acceptance. What's a tragic irony is that when Alan Turing died, things were just about to start to change. He died on the 7th of June in 1954. Well, on the 8th of July of that year, a month after, almost to the day of his death, Lord Wolfenden was appointed to head a commission, a committee of British government, which then came to carry his name, the Wolfenden Commission. And they eventually issued a report, the Wolfenden Report. They were charged with coming up with recommendations for the legal status of homosexuality and prostitution, things that we would, you know, today call victimless crime. The report was issued in 1957, the recommendations enacted only in 1967. As for their bottom line conclusion as to what should be done with homosexuality, I will read to you their one set conclusion here. Homosexual behavior between consenting adults in private should no longer be a criminal offense. Okay, that was because the argument, this was not the terminology used then, was that this was a victimless crime, and so why should the state stick its nose into it? Well, I would say, though, that what we're talking about here is not a victimless crime. Alan Turing, what happened to Alan Turing was criminal, and he was the victim. So, if this wasn't a victimless crime, then, what kind of crime was it? Well, a clue is afforded by an apology issued to Alan Turing in 2009 by then British Prime Minister Gordon Brown. This was as a result of a call, a certain amount of public pressure for some kind of compensation for Turing, even posthumously. And Brown issued an apology, which I believe was sincere. I have every reason to believe was sincere, honestly meant. Among other things, Brown said following, quote, Turing was dealt with under the law of the time, unquote. So I gather that Brown said that in order not to be misunderstood, that he was trying to fault the police or the judicial system at all. He likely did not want to be misunderstood as criticizing anybody who was involved with Turing's prosecution, because the laws were as they were and these people were just doing their job. Okay, so what we have then is not a victimless crime, it was a perpetratorless crime. It just sort of happened, and nobody's responsible for it. Well, okay, given that, what other perpetratorless crimes have been committed against us? I would say that the primary example would be the emptiness in public space of any sort of discussion of gay issues. Throughout most of the 20th century, you could barely find a word spoken about this. I think the best example of this is from a poem that I will read you a part of. With apologies to the non-native English speakers here, I find poetry difficult enough in my own language. I dare not guess what it would be like for the non-native English speakers here. So this is a poem entitled Two Loves by Lord Alfred Douglas. In the beginning, the narrator is describing a dream that he's having where he's on a hill, and he sees these two guys walking around there. You know, it's, you know, nice sunny day, and there are clouds, and he's in a field and everything. And one of the guys looks really great. He's all happy, and he's having a good time. But he that was his comrade walked aside. He was full, sad, and sweet. and his large eyes were strange with wondrous brightness, staring wide with gazing. And he sighed with many sighs that moved me, and his cheeks were wan and white like pallid lilies, and his lips were red like poppies, and his hands he clenched tight and yet again unclenched, and his head was wreathed with moonflowers pale as lips of death. A purple robe he wore, or wrought in gold with the device of a great snake, whose breath was fiery flame, which, when I did behold, I fell a-weeping. And I cried, "Sweet youth, tell me why, sad and sighing, thou dost rove these pleasant realms. I pray thee speak me sooth, what is thy name?" He said, "My name is Love." Then straight the first did turn himself to me and cried, "He lieth, for his name is Shame. But I am Love, and I was wont to be alone in this fair garden till he came unasked by night. I am true love. I fill the hearts of boy and girl with mutual flame." Then sighing, said the other, "Have I will. I am the love that dare not speak its name." What other examples of such perpetratorless crimes have there been? Well, another is the suppression of history. Pretty much the lack of historical figures to turn to as role models, the lack of historical precedent to look at, the complete absence of other ideas on the subject. An example of this that I would like to give also comes from literature. This comes from the novel Morris, which was written by E.M. Foster, whom I mentioned earlier, also a graduate of King's College, lived during Turing's time, so this very much comes from Turing's cultural milieu. I'm going on my memory here of the film version of Morris that I saw. There was a classroom, a philosophy class, and a student was reading out loud a passage from Plato. And he's just about to come to a spot where you could find, as happens on occasion in Plato, some reference to, you know, appreciating the beauty of young boys and enjoying their love or something like that. Right before the student got to that passage, the instructor said, "Omit reference to the unmentionable vice of the Greeks." Even today, there are instances of exactly this kind of censorship happening. There is speculation that Ataturk, the founder of modern Turkey, was gay. Now, there is no real hard evidence for this, as I understand it. Evidence is only circumstantial. But you realize that's all we have to go on for something like this. You know, back in the day, people way would have covered something like this up. So it is the kind of thing which, you know, is speculative. And why shouldn't people speculate about it? Well, in Turkey, it's illegal to insult Ataturk. And even suggesting that he was gay, whether you consider it an insult or not, is considered by the Turkish government to be an insult. And you can get into trouble for it there. So, rewriting of history, you know all about that one. There was a lot of film censorship going on at the time. And I'm talking about the United States. Okay, this was not state-sponsored censorship, but there was in the 20s, 30s, 40s, there was a voluntary code that the movie studios adhered to, where they didn't have any kind of rating system the way we do these days, and the market was smaller than it is now. So you didn't want to have one kind of film that you could only show in the big cities where attitudes were more tolerant, and then what do you do, you know, for the countryside? So there was a voluntary code as to what could appear in the movies and what couldn't appear. Well, homosexuality was forbidden. It was one of those things that could not be mentioned. Don't think that it was general attitudes at the time that would have prevented this from happening. In fact, the first film that I'm aware of in which homosexuality appears at all portrayed it in a very positive light. this was, the moving shaker behind this film was Magnus Hirschfeld, another very interesting historical figure who I think should be a lot better known than he is. He was, I guess what we would call these days, a gay rights activist, but even more than that, he was the first person who, I would say, studied sex scientifically. Now, to be sure, Freud lived at the same time. I'm talking early 20th century here. Freud lived at the time, and Freud considered his work scientific. But Freud's method was the case study. He would take one of his patients and analyze their dreams and their psyche in depth. These days, we would tend to consider that something more like philosophy. What we would count as hard science would be statistics, data, numbers, the kind of stuff you'll find in Kinsey. Well, Hirschfeld was the first one to do something like that. So he did, you know, surveys of, you know, factory workers in Berlin and this kind of stuff, and he came up with the astoundingly high figure that it was probably 0.5% of the population that was gay, which just seemed, you know, so high as to be unbelievable back then. Of course, these days we know it's more like 5%. But, you know, you don't have information back then. So he had a film in 1919 called Anders als die anderen, that, which means different from the others, but it's much cleverer in German. And it was a very sympathetic portrayal of the situation of gays at that time. Well, that was in 1919. Things clamped down a bit after that. So even in films where, by rights, there should have been some gay theme, some point, some place or other, it wasn't there. For instance, there was a film made of the Leopold and Loeb case, a famous case in Chicago where two young men killed a boy just to show that they could do it and get away with it. Well, they didn't get away with it in the end. And there was apparently some sexual tension between the two perpetrators there. But in the film, that gets nothing more than a very fleeting and indistinct, indirect reference. It was also a film of Mädchen in Uniform, Girls in Uniform, which was a German novel about a woman's boarding school. There was, the novel turned around the relationship between one of the female teachers and one of the female students. And it was brimming with sexual tension in the original novel. That was a large part of the point of the book, and it just wasn't there to be found in the film. There was a time well-known case involving the U.S. Post Office. In 1954, the Los Angeles postmaster refused to send the copies of Mattachine Society's magazine called One through the mail. The Mattachine Society was an early gay rights organization. This is the 50s we're talking about. It was a small group and must have taken a lot of courage to join it at the time. And they had a publication, which is a newsletter. Let me make clear, it's not pornography, not by any standard at all. If there were any photos there, they would be headshots of somebody. There were reports of meetings that they had, the treasurer's report, the meeting from the secretary. It probably read like the minutes of your departmental meeting, you know? But just the fact that it mentioned homosexuality was enough for the LA postmasters to say, this is obscene and cannot be carried through the mail. Well, the Mattachine Society took the post office to court. Two courts ruled in favor of the post office until finally in 1958, 4 years later, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Mattachine Society. So, yes, there were victories, but definitely hard fought. Let's not forget our classification by the APA, the American Psychiatric Association, as sick. Homosexuality was considered an illness. Why? It's a good question. Was there any evidence for this? On what basis did they make that classification in the first place? Probably what they considered common sense, but there you have it. So, bottom line, back in the day in Turing's life, we were illegal, we were immoral, we were insane. This started to change. Eventually, the not purely symbolic starting point was the Stonewall Riots in New York City in 1969. It was a police raid on a gay bar, which was fairly common at the time, Often, somebody in the police department was getting paid off, so the bar would be tipped and the people would then, you know, go home and no harm done in the end. Well, this time, for some reason, the communication didn't work and a lot of people ended up being arrested. This was 1969, I'll remind you. We have Vietnam here, the hippies, moon landings, the women's rights movement, the civil rights movement, lots of stuff going on. And as people were being rounded up, at a certain point, they just started to say to themselves, why are we putting up with this? And they fought back. They did not walk into the paddy wagon the way they did before. They said, we're not going. And they started to attack the police. Police had to run into the Stonewall Bar and barricade the door to protect themselves and call out reinforcements. So that was a great start to what's become a long-lasting movement as to represent the sea change that this made in public attitudes and just in the whole environment. For our purposes, this is best indicated by a letter that was printed in Time magazine in September of 1975, which I will read to you in its entirety. Homosexuality was once called, quote, the love that dare not speak its name, unquote. Now it won't shut up. Another good way to understand how this, what this change was and what difference it made was to think of the celebrations that are happening around the world this very month. June is called Gay Pride Month because that's when the Stonewall Riot happened. That's why it was June. But think of that name. You know, so often there's a name for something, you just use a name, and you don't think about what it means. Just think, Gay Pride. You're supposed to be proud of being gay. The reason that was chosen, I'm sure, was because back in the day, there was this overwhelming feeling of shame. What's the worst insult that can be thrown in a schoolyard to a young boy? According to my memory, it's fag. From the early days, you're taught this is the worst thing that you could possibly be. I remember when I started to be aware what my sexuality was, I could barely get the word over my lips. So for us, I would say this change is comparable to make a perhaps somewhat exaggerated analogy here, comparable to the French Revolution. I'm thinking of part of Dickens' Tale of Two Cities. Dr. Manet, maybe this is Minette. I don't want to lean on my French pronunciation. Had been a prisoner of the Bastille. And while before the revolution, this was actually a source of shame for the family because he had suffered certain psychic damage from his time there. And while it was very difficult and shameful for the family. But after the revolution, it was a badge of honor. It was a source of pride. He would, if he needed to get something done, there would be cries of, long live the Bastille prisoner. The Stonewall Riot wasn't nearly as violent as the French Revolution. But for us, the change, I would say, was as big. In 1972 and 1973, we saw the overturn of the APA classification of homosexuality as an illness. There are still a lot of problems here. My knowledge is more what happens in the US. There was the whole Anita Bryan thing right in my area. I live in South Florida. Americans might remember that whole thing. Anita Bryan was a very important figure in US history. At the time, in the late 60s, early 70s, there was the beginning of gay rights protection legislation. Not on the basis of a mass movement, but you know, the Mattachine Society and groups like that, groups that were forming, were going quietly and in very middle class, sedate fashion to local city councils and getting some legislation passed. Well, some people who think that they're Christian got all up in arms about this. And Anita Bryant became their leader. There was such an ordinance passed in Miami, where she lived, and she got a petition campaign to put it on the referendum, and her referendum passed. By a popular vote, the gay rights protection legislation in Miami-Dade County was overturned. And this was the end of gay rights legislation for a while. She then went around the country overturning as many laws as she could get her hands on. Finally stopped in California with Harvey Milk, but let me not digress too much here. What makes Anita Bryant's story so important is, so far as I can tell, this is the revival of the religious right in America. The last I remember hearing about the religious right was the Scopes Monkey Trial back in the 20s. And after that, so far as I understand it, they remained out of politics. They were doing their stuff with their televangelists, raising money in revival meetings and so on. They were not mixing in national politics. Well, Anita Bryant changed all of that in the mid-70s, and we're still living with that to this day. So there's that opposition. There was Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the military policy that we only recently overturned. There is DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, which is kind of getting shaky now, but it was passed a while ago. There are beatings that happen. You can still be killed in the US today for being gay, to say nothing of what's happening in other countries around the world. I read regularly of gay rights marches that they try to hold in Eastern Europe, any of these Eastern European countries, and sometimes the permits aren't even allowed, the city authorities won't even allow it, or if they're there, there might be police separating the pro-gay demonstrators from the more numerous anti-gay demonstrators, and sometimes the sympathies of the police are not necessarily always to protect people. So there's, dare I say anything about the Muslim world here? There are some places we all live. In the US, if you're killed for being gay, it's illegal to do that. In some places, the state might execute you for being gay. So there's still a lot of opposition. But the crimes are no longer perpetratorless. We know who's doing it. They have to stand up. They have to be accounted. And sometimes they're called to account. Sadly, Turing didn't get to see any of this. But how important would general social acceptance have been to him anyway? We could talk a bit more specifically about professional acceptance. Turing apparently was very matter-of-fact about his homosexuality. He made no big bones about it. It would, you know, come up, and he apparently didn't think it was that big a deal one way or the other. So unimportant, he wasn't even anything like a civil rights advocate. But he was living in a society with a presumption of heterosexuality, and his announcements were not always very well received. In particular, I'm thinking of Don Bailey, a colleague of Turing's after the war. If you read the biographies, you'll get some detail about how Bailey was sort of outraged that Turing was gay, and even more so that Turing didn't seem to be ashamed of it, that he seemed to think that it was normal. This, I can say, has been very different from my experiences. I'm happy to be able to report. I remember when I was a grad student, still wondering whether this was going to fly at all, how safe I was going to be in my professional context. I was at a meeting, I think it was MAML's, Mid-Atlantic Mathematical Logic Seminar, and if I remember correctly, Lee Stanley, a logician from Lehigh University, suggested that at some point we all go see Breaking the Code, which was then playing on Broadway. And there was general acceptance that this would be a good thing to do. I experienced a moment of vertigo there because I had associated that play, you know, and touring more with gay history, and I just realized, you know, as I'd heard about the play and the gay group I was going to at the time, and it was like, you know, well, where am I here? Oh, that's right. These people also like touring. Yeah, that's right. So I thought for a moment, you know, whose side are they going to be on? You know, I had to think, how are they going to react to this? You know, are they going to say, oh, well, Turing was a great mathematician, but, you know, he was a little funny around the edges, or, you know, what would people's attitude be? And it occurred to me, you know, if we look at this very abstractly, what's the story about? It's about a great mathematician who was somehow out of step with society. Now, what mathematician would not be sympathetic to the mathematician in that story? And I realized immediately in a flash that I'm going to be okay. It'll be fine. And I would like to take this moment to thank you all for that. I'm aware of the idea that I really shouldn't be thanking you for what's my due anyway, and also that it's not really anything personal from anything personally toward me. It's not as though anybody's cutting, you know, me in particular any slack. You're expressing your own values. But it is personal for me because it sure has made a difference in my life. And there's nothing wrong with showing gratitude and appreciation on occasion. So, thank you all. So, let me bring you back to Tori, because this is not primarily about me. What was it for Tori? Why did he do it? Why did he kill himself? Was it the lack of a gay community there, of his own community? Was it the lack of acceptance from the wider society or from his professional colleagues? I don't think so. Turing was an independent guy. He was an independent thinker and an independent personality. He had some friends, both straight and gay. He was very highly regarded among his colleagues. He had a good, solid relationship with his mother. He was over 40 years old at that point. He was somewhat adjusted to his situation by then. He had his own community. So why did he do it? Well, let's turn back to the proximal cause of what got him into trouble. He was burgled from an acquaintance of somebody who was trying to establish a relationship.
Can't hear you.
Thank you. Turing was burgled from an acquaintance of somebody he was trying to establish a relationship with. Turing wanted a lover. I'm reminded at this moment of Christopher Morcom. He was a friend of Turing's in his private school. We call it private school, the public schools here. When he was in high school, he was a friend of his to whom he was extraordinarily attached. There has been speculation that, and then Morcom was going to go to Cambridge, was it King's College? But in the summer between high school and matriculation to college, Morcom passed away unexpectedly. There has been speculation that Turing was so attached to Morcom, so devastated by the loss, that he couldn't get any other romances. That he was so emotionally bound up with Morcom that no actual living person could ever measure up against the memory of his childhood friend. So I think this illustrates clearly that Turing wanted to have a partner. This is perhaps not self-evident. Not everybody really cares about that, but Turing did. He may not have been the most socially astute, socially suave person around, but he was still socially oriented enough that he wanted human connection. So perhaps Alan Turing is really the most modern of us all. He didn't die from homophobia. He had good self-esteem. He wasn't ashamed. He had pride. Maybe like very many people, even today, both gay and straight, Turing died because he was lonely.